Late one summer afternoon, Fogel received a phone call from his secretary, who identified himself as working for a man so powerful that Fogel trembled when he heard the name and could not stop trembling until he decided to think of him not by name, but only as Commandant H.G., though he could not have said why this should be any less disturbing. Fogel had imagined this phone call so often that when it finally came, it was as if it had happened so often as to have become tedious. In fact, he thought about getting the call less often than about not getting one. So many others had. Frequently, the commandant summoned the highest level artisans and purveyors, dealers in furs and antiques, to parties at his villas in the suburbs of Berlin. It was traditional for guests to lavish their hosts with gifts, in return for which the commandant sent the best customers their way. At one such party, the commandant arranged for his guests to meet him in a meadow. He drove up in a sports car, wearing goggles, a leather cap, and a floor-length ermine coat. Shouting through a megaphone, he lectured the group on animal husbandry, then tried to get a bull to mate with a cow as a demonstration, then gave up and ordered the guests to meet him back at the house where he greeted them, dressed as one of the three wise men, in a mink trim turban and a brocade caftan. Fogel was especially sorry to have missed something like that. Fogel's wife had repeatedly asked him why they weren't invited to the commandant's like this, or that girlfriend who wasn't any prettier than she was, and whose husband wasn't any richer than Fogel. The car that picked him up was driven by two junior officers in the Luftwaffe. Fogel had hoped to find out from their conversation to what sort of party he'd been asked, but neither of the handsome young men spoke as they headed toward the edge of the city. For a moment, Fogel had the ridiculous notion that his companions were uniformed store window mannequins or ingenious automatons. As the houses grew sparse and the headlights became the only light beside the moon, he thought, surely we will be there soon. But they kept on driving. Eventually, his uneasiness was replaced by the pleasant sensation that he had waited exactly the right amount of time and was being rewarded for his patience by the fact that the warm air streaming in the window was scented with orange blossoms, literally inebriating, so that when they turned off the road and a gate swung open, Vogel felt he had already enjoyed a glass or two of expensive champagne. Fogel found himself at the door to a huge room, its high ceiling supported by massive, rough-hewn beams. Candles burned in candelabras made from braces of antlers, the hides of exotic animals lay about on the floor. At the far end was a fireplace, and in front of it, a long couch. On the couch sat a woman with her back to the door. How strange a roaring fire in July when one would expect stifling air trapped among the heraldic flags and beneath the fur of the safari trophies. But in fact, the room exuded a glacial chill as if frozen forever in the endless winter of some Teutonic chieftain. Here the lieutenants left him, and Fogel approached the woman, who continued gazing into the fire without turning, which was lucky, because more readjustment was required as Fogel understood that he had not been called to see the commandant, but rather his wife, suggesting that his secret mission had something to do with jewelry. Fortunately, he'd brought along a pocket watch on an aviation theme for the commandant and a pretty bangle for his wife, platinum studded with ruby chips. That is, for the commandant's second wife, famously unhappy because her husband was still grieving for the first wife after whom he named everything, his yachts, his stables, his villa. Every year, on the anniversary of her death, the commandant held a gathering at which black-robed guests listened to the solemn chanting of monks imported from Greece. Fogel had heard all this from his own wife, who loved this sort of gossip. As he approached the woman, Fogel noted that the angle of her head and the slope of her shoulders, both bare white arms, were outstretched along the top of the couch, expressed some deep, mysterious melancholy. She remained so still that Fogel felt as if he were looking at a painting he'd seen and knew by name, a woman sunk in sorrow. A curl of smoke twisted up from a cigarette she held in an ivory holder. Fogel supposed he should make a warning noise, but the soles of his good leather shoes brushed silently against the marble, and everything else, a cough, a clear throat, seemed rude and artificial. It occurred to him that the woman knew he was there, and that not acknowledging him was something only a woman would do. Fogel liked women whom he found not only charming, but usually smarter and wittier than their husbands. And women intuited that, which surprisingly was all it took to be what was called lucky with women. They liked it if a man had thoughts that were flowery, but not too flowery, and if he told them some of those thoughts in a slightly ironic tone that created a kind of privacy, just the two of them together. Also, it was amazing what happened to a woman between the moment she admired a piece of jewelry in the window of his store and the moment she walked in and found him alone there. Vogel prided himself on never having taken advantage of the desperate Jewish women, so though some of them had been extremely pretty. His standards were more relaxed with the casual shoppers. Vogel's wife had been one of those. Their married joke was that an amethyst had arranged the introduction. Since his wedding, there had been other girls, not many, but enough so that Fogel felt he was still in practice and could deal with whatever the evening ahead might bring. How accommodatingly his fantasies had shifted from power to sex. Obviously, it would be suicide to flirt with the commandant's wife, but in Vogel's experience, one could have a lot of fun before it qualified as flirtation. Energized by the prospect of bringing a smile to the lips of the grieving woman, he walked around in front of her. Of course, she knew he was there. She was wearing a sleeveless green velvet gown, Grecian or medieval. She rearranged the skirt, uncrossing and recrossing her legs as she waved him to the chair at her right. Sighing deeply, she threw back her head and shut her eyes. Then she roused herself and offered Vogel a cigarette from the silver tray, probably Venetian. As he leaned forward to take it, he saw, by the flickering light, what he had known from across the room, but had refused to admit. It was not the commandant's wife, but the commandant. That, too, was gossip unheard. That the commandant's fondness for extravagant costumes sometimes led him to borrow his wife's gowns. Some said this had started after the death of his first wife. Others said he had been like that as a child, and as a bold aviator flying bombing missions with blonde ringlet wigs stuffed under his helmet. So Fogel was less startled than he might have been to find himself alone with the former president of the Reichstag and the chief commandant of the Luftwaffe in a pair of high-heeled sandals with pom-poms on the straps. Even so, it was unsettling. Vogel could understand the commandant indulging this eccentric wing in the company of his wife and trusted friends, but Vogel was a stranger, a jeweler from Berlin. He concentrated on keeping control of his face so that when the commandant looked at him, he saw what exactly? No surprise, no surprise in the least. Admiration, appreciation, perhaps even that was excessive. A purely relaxed, neutral friendliness. Mixed, of course, with respect. But the most important thing was not to show or think that this was in any way abnormal. Thank you.